Right, so we're going to talk about the moral grammar of the human person as a body-soul unity. And I'm going to be using as my example, morality deals with human action, concrete human action, and we'll be focusing on sexual morality when we get to it. But I say that because I just want to alert you to the fact that, as you all know, Catholic moral teaching, especially on sexual matters, is highly controversial and highly countercultural. And often the prevailing popular impression is that Catholic moral teaching is about, what, a set of arbitrary rules, mostly a set of prohibitions, whereby these celibate old men, they just shake their fingers at the world and say, don't do this, don't do that. And that the Catholic Church has a disdain for human sexuality. It sees sexual activity as tainted in its core. This is kind of the impression. When I was a graduate student in Freiburg, Switzerland, the local paper, La Liberté, it ran a cartoon one time in which a Catholic couple, they were in bed under the covers with crucifix on the wall. That's how you knew they were Catholic, right? And one of them was saying to the other, can we come out from under the covers now? Right? The truth of the matter is quite different. What I would argue, and which my remarks tonight will largely center on, is that at the core and the foundation of Catholic moral teaching is a certain vision of being human. That is a certain conception of the fundamental structure of the human person, of how the human being is constituted. At the foundation of Catholic moral teaching is an understanding of how God has designed us, and thus how he intends us to live in view of that design. And an understanding known by faith, divine revelation, and also by reason alone, philosophy. Catholic moral teaching flows from not only an understanding of that design, but a love for it. A love for how God has designed us and how God intends us to live. A good voice piece for this understanding is Pope Benedict XVI. Back in 2012, in a little-known address to the Roman Curia, Pope Benedict asserted that a new philosophy of sexuality had taken hold of Western culture, and that this new philosophy of sexuality calls into question, quote, the very notion of what being human really means. Still quoting Pope Benedict, Catholic moral teaching, for its part, articulates what is, quote, these again are his words, what's inscribed in human nature itself, and thus accessible to reason and common to all humanity. So there you have it. Catholic moral teaching, at bottom, is a humanist vision. It's, at bottom, a vision about what it really means to be human. By proposing a vision of what being human truly means, Catholic moral teaching proposes, then, a vision of beauty, of happiness, and freedom for the human person. Okay? So let's turn to a consideration of this notion of the fundamental structure of the human person. Okay, as indicated by the title of this lecture, the fundamental structure of the human person that Catholic teaching adopts is that of a body-soul composite unity, a union of matter or physicality and spirit. We can call this an integrated anthropology or a hylomorphic anthropology. That's an Aristotelian-inspired word. It simply means the union of matter and form. Okay, it's a vision of being human that boasts a rather robust philosophical pedigree, principally an Aristotelian one, and at the same time, it's culled from a biblical account of the human person. Thomas Aquinas would, of course, bring together these two notions of the human person, the one Aristotelian and the other biblical, and from him it would pass to the Church's common tradition. Before we delve more deeply into this biblical Aristotelian notion of the human person, especially as Thomas Aquinas articulates it, let's consider the rival anthropologies that abound today. That is, competing notions about what it means to be human, competing visions of the human person. We can point to two in particular. with each one sitting at polar ends opposing this biblical Aristotelian hylomorphic view of the human person. Both have been common prevailing views in the history of human thought, and both remain quite vibrant and popular options today. Indeed, just as the biblical Aristotelian vision of the human person provides the foundation of Catholic moral teaching, so, I would argue, do these rival notions of the human person act as the source of the moral values of Western secular culture that predominate today, especially when we're talking about what Pope Benedict called today's new philosophy of sexuality. So it's imperative that we understand them. Okay? These rival anthropologies are easy to grasp if we see them in relation to the biblical Aristotelian vision of the human person as a body-soul composite unity. Painting in broad strokes, in the case of one, and sitting at one extreme, the human person is purported to be a body alone. In the case of the other, and sitting at the polar opposite extreme, the human person is held to be a soul alone. Since both rival notions of the human person deny one essential aspect of our nature, either the body or the soul, both can be considered and called fragmented anthropologies. Okay? So let's turn then to the materialist notion of the human person. The notion that the human being is nothing more than a body, a physical thing. We're different from the rest of the animal kingdom, say, only by our more advanced DNA design. This notion of the human person is held by many scientists and philosophers today. Though not new in the history of human thought, some ancient Greco-Roman philosophers were materialists. This view of human nature has become popular today largely on account of the dominant role that modern science and the scientific method play in modern society, especially as regards human knowledge and truth-finding. Think about it. In today's culture, for something to be regarded as objectively and certifiably true, what must we be able to say about it? That it is somehow measurable or verifiable through the scientific method and instrumentation, right? Scientism and materialism fit hand in glove. The view that only the physical or the material exists and that all of reality can thus be known through the scientific method and explained in scientific terms. This materialist anthropology thus flattens out human life entirely. It's a reductionist anthropology because it reduces all human action and all human purpose to this material world here below. It denies a spiritual dimension to human life and thus a transcendent side to human nature. That is, there is no aspect of our humanity that transcends the body or the material realm. If we're only a body, it's thus nonsensical to speak of the human person as existing for anything beyond this world, namely for the absolute, for the infinite, for truth, for beauty, for goodness, for God. It's also nonsensical on this account to speak of there being a moral dimension to human life. Indeed, to there being any real interiority to the human person at all. All human action is explained in terms of neurochemical phenomena. We act upon nothing more than nerve twitches. And so, belief in God is reduced, say, to a part of the brain called the God spot. You've heard that? Human love is reduced to the neurotransmitter oxytocin. Note here, for clarification purposes, the issue here is not that we're saying the human brain plays no role in our believing in God, or that oxytocin plays no role in our human relationships. The issue here is explaining belief in God exclusively in terms of brain activity, or holding that human love is entirely explainable in terms of the hormone oxytocin. The both-and principle is at play here, which is so integral to Catholic tradition and Catholic teaching. It can both be true that the brain plays a necessary, albeit partial, role in our knowledge of God, and that the brain on its own cannot account for our knowledge of God. It's not either or. Either the brain accounts for our belief in God, or it plays no role whatsoever in our belief in God. Either oxytocin determines on its own human love, or it plays no role whatsoever. No, it's a both and proposition. Since human interiority is reduced to neurochemical phenomena, free will, on this view, is an absurdity. And with no free will, there's no real responsibility over our actions. By denying any real responsibility over our actions, we drain human life of all real adventure and drama and romance. The great adventure and drama of human life assumes, does it not, that in most of our actions, we are not constrained to act one way or another. That is, that our actions are not determined by what our neurochemicals dictate. They're not determined by nerve twitches alone. Does it take much thought to readily see the moral consequences of this notion of the human person, especially as they concern the human body? Since a materialist anthropology renders all talk of moral action and moral responsibility nonsensical, it eliminates all talk of the body as enjoying any moral worth or dignity. With the body having no moral worth or dignity, it follows that we can do whatever we want with it. We can treat the body as a recreational playground. Hello, hookup culture. Hello, drug use. We can treat the body as a means to an end, as a pure instrument, as an object of manipulation and control, especially by means of technology. Hello, euthanasia, doctor-assisted suicide, artificial reproductive technology, and the list goes on. Okay, let's turn to the other rival anthropology, the view that the human person is a soul alone. We can call this anthropology Cartesianist, named after the 17th century philosopher René Descartes. We could also call it Gnostic or Angelistic. Whatever the nomenclature, the human being is conceived here not as a body-soul unity, but as an autonomous, thinking, choosing self, who is only loosely or accidentally bound to a body. To cite Descartes, you can see it there on the screen, I thereby concluded that I was a substance whose whole essence or nature resides only in thinking, and which is not dependent on any material thing. Accordingly, this I, that is to say, the soul by which I am what I am, is entirely distinct, and we should really understand that to mean separate, is entirely distinct from the body, end quote. The ancient philosopher Plato went even further. He looked upon the body as a prison or a tomb of the soul. With Plato, then, we find ourselves in the foyer of Gnosticism, famous for its disdaining the body, along with all material reality, as inherently evil. So according to this Cartesianist vision of the human person, the body, with its biological hardwiring, weighs upon the soul as a kind of albatross that stands as an inimical threat or rival to the autonomy of the thinking, choosing self. Seeking to explain the traction that this notion of the human person has gained in modern times, the author Wendell Berry observes that this view, quote, looks upon the body as upon the natural world, as an encumbrance of the soul, and so hates the body as it hates the natural world and longs to be free of it, end quote. I think that's accurate. Looking upon the body as completely malleable, this anthropology encourages us to exploit and conquer our bodies, if only to free the soul from its chains, a recast to fit unbridled self-will. Descartes himself expressly asserts that the goal is to, quote, make ourselves, as it were, the masters and possessors of nature, end quote. By extension, we could say the masters and possessors of our own bodies. As with the materialist notion of the human person, so with the Cartesianist one, we can readily see the moral consequences that ensue, especially as they concern the body. They are, in fact, the same as the consequences of the materialist anthropology, even if this Cartesianist one sits at the opposite extreme. Your body, you see, is not truly part of you. You are not your body. It's not part of your personhood. And since your responsibility as a moral agent belongs to you as a person, it follows that your body plays no inherent moral worth, it enjoys no inherent moral worth or dignity. Your body does not carry moral responsibility with it. If that's the case, what can you do with it? Anything you want. Treat it as a plaything, again, as a recreational playground, sure. Treat it as an instrument, as a tool for some other end, as an object of manipulation and control, sure. What I'm suggesting and trying to have you see, in other words, is that the modern secular approach to sexual choices and lifestyles especially, to choose that example, is largely predicated, even if implicitly, on this Cartesian-styled anthropology. Okay, I'm not suggesting here that your average person on the street is reading Descartes, okay, and walking around calling himself a Cartesian. No, it's rather that the Cartesianist view of the human person has sunk deep in our cultural well, as it were, so that it's in the air that we breathe and in the water that we drink, so to speak, whether we're consciously aware of it or not. Don't take my word for it, take Pope Benedict's. In the same address that I cited earlier, Pope Benedict noted that today's new philosophy of sexuality conceives of the human being as, quote, merely spirit and will, and denies the fact that bodily identity serves as a defining element of the human being, end quote. How else to read the current predominant attitude taken toward our biological design, especially as it concerns sexual identity and gender theory and the ordering to procreation? As for sexual identity and gender theory, consider what the plastic surgeon and first director of the Johns Hopkins Gender Identity Clinic, Dr. John Hoops, said of transgender individuals at the clinic's opening in 1966. Quote, if the mind cannot be changed to fit the body, then perhaps we should consider changing the body to fit the mind. Or consider what the American Psychological Association asserted in its report from exactly 1 year ago, titled Harmful Masculinity. Quote, the concept of gender roles is not cast as a biological phenomenon, but rather a psychological and socially constructed set of ideas that are malleable to change. End quote. Gender, on this view, is of the mind and not a matter of biology. We know the results of this. If you insist that one's sexual self-identity or gender remains essentially linked to one's biological sex, you can be accused what? Of bigotry, discrimination, etc. As regards the biological ordering of procreation, is it not the case that today this is largely seen as impertinent, if not outright hostile to sexual love, unless we choose to make it otherwise? And it's placing no inherent moral obligation upon us. Sex is largely seen, is it not, as an affair of internal desire and love, with the biologically structured body standing on the outside looking in, save for the pleasure involved. Possessing no inherent moral worth because non-essential to our human identity, the body can be molded like clay to fit purely utilitarian purposes. See, for instance, sex realignment surgeries, and so on. Or treated recreationally like a toy. Again, consider hookup sex, friends with benefits, etc. Consent, nebulously defined and provided by the self, the soul, meets the only necessary condition for morally acceptable sexual activity. And these are not necessarily value statements. They're really meant to be factual statements. Indeed, many people don't mind being Cartesianist in their approach to sex and morality at all. even certain Catholic theologians and moralists who dissent from the Church's teaching on sexual morality harbor a Cartesian-like disdain for the body. We know it because of how they speak in disparaging terms of what they'll term biological function and procreative processes. One, for instance, tells us that Catholic moral teaching is driven by, quote, an obsession with the mechanics of the procreative process, end quote. Another accuses the Church of, quote, reducing sex to a mere biological function and of turning human sexuality into a barnyard-like animal affair, end quote. We should not be fooled here. Such language acts as nothing more than a ruse, camouflaging an underlying Cartesian-like bias against the physical or biological order. Descartes' dream of our becoming masters and possessors of nature, in this case, masters and possessors of our sexed bodies, has been realized. Not mincing words, the same Pope Benedict XVI, this time in his inaugural encyclical letter, Deus Caritas Est, charges this approach to sexual practice as tantamount to a veritable, quote, debasement of the human body and a hatred of human bodiliness, end quote. Okay, this brings us back then to the biblical Aristotelian vision of the human person as an integrated whole, as a body-soul composite unity, the one, of course, that the Church uses, the one that's favored by the Church. Here, the individual human person is as much identified with his body as with his soul. A paradoxical union of matter and spirit, the human being is yet one. We are not centaur-like creatures. You know what centaurs are, right? Half rational, half bestial, with like a clean line of separation between the two. We are integrated, unified beings, comprising both animal and rational dimensions, both rational and subrational dimensions. We are one. How is this notion of the human person biblically inspired? The Genesis creation account makes this clear, as we read in Genesis 2:7. Then the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground of the body, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, infused a rational soul into that body. And man became a living being. Supporting this from a philosophical perspective is the Aristotelian view that all things, save God and the angels, are composed of matter and form, that is, material stuff or arranged, specified via the form into particular kinds of things. Like, consider, you know, like how the material stuff of metal and plastic and glass is determined by a respective form, either to be the cell phone or the laptop. Aquinas, of course, would fuse these two accounts, the biblical one and the Aristotelian ones, together. For him, the human being is a unified composite of organic matter, which we share with all other animals, and a rational form or soul, which is unique to us. The human person is constituted by an animal body, dust from the ground, from Genesis, and an immaterial or spiritual soul, breath of life. The Church's common tradition has made this language its own. The Catechism of the Catholic Church, number 365, citing the Council of Vienne, which met in 1311 to 1312, affirms, quote, the unity of soul and body is so profound that one has to consider the soul to be the form of the body. Spirit and matter and man are not two natures united, but rather their union forms a single nature. End quote. Pope Benedict says the same thing in Deus Caritas Est, number 5, quote, it is neither the spirit alone nor the body alone that loves. It is man, the person, a unified creature composed of body and soul who loves. End quote. Needless to say, by appropriating this notion of the human person, the Church holds to an elevated view of the human body. Aquinas himself, wishing to underscore the nobility of the body, and aware that matter, or body, is for the sake of form, soul, asserts that the human body, because of its dignity of being fitted or designed for a rational soul, stands apart from all other bodies as the most excellent expression of the divine art. Just, you know, think of like our hip bones, think of our larynx, think of the opposable thumb, think of the fact that we have two eyes in the front of our face that allows us to look out straight. For Aquinas, the human body is God's artistic masterpiece. This is beautiful language. In his great poem, The Divine Comedy, Dante, who was himself deeply influenced by Thomas Aquinas, Dante, wishing to show that the human body is no husk or shell, refers to the human body as a radiant royal robe for the human soul. Human beings are not angels. We are not free-floating, disembodied spirits. And indeed, St. Paul himself gives us the strongest language of all. The body, he says, is nothing less than the temple of the Holy Spirit. 1 Corinthians 6:19. Okay, the moral consequences of this view of the human person, especially as they concern the body, are obvious. Integral to our human identity, the body enjoys inherent moral worth and dignity, since what you do to your bodies, you do to your very selves. To treat your body well is to treat your persons well. To abuse your body is to abuse your very persons. This is why the church uses such strong language when it concerns an abuse of your body. The immoral man sins against his own body, St. Paul tells us. And so he follows with the charge to, quote, glorify God in your body. 1 Corinthians 6:18 to 20. So, there you have it. Two distinct notions of the human person, with each defined by its distinct regard for the human body. Either the human body is God's artistic masterpiece, as the temple of the Holy Spirit, as the necessary counterpart to the soul, as matter always is to form, or the human body, either as a barnyard-like, biologically structured accessory, or is devoid of a transcendent soul. If the former, the body is God's artistic masterpiece, sees the human being as a paradoxical unity, as an integrated whole, the latter reduces the human being to a fragmented self, to use the term that St. Augustine employs when he was describing his earlier life of sexual dissipation in the Confessions. The Church, to repeat, has cast her lot with the view of man as a paradoxical unity. Since it coheres with the biblical witness, a witness that is undergirded by a proper and quite robust metaphysics of human nature, an Aristotelian hylomorphism. What emerges from this integrated view of the human person is the entirety of Catholic moral teaching, inclusive of the meaning and purpose of sex. Hence, the title that I gave this lecture, The Moral Grammar of the Human Person as a Body-Soul Unity. So let's just consider how this plays out in the arena of human sexual action. Okay, so we're going to talk about the moral meaning and direction of human sexuality. Our sexuality is expressive of our body-soul design in a particularly unique and privileged way. How so? First, that human sexuality flows primarily upon the body, upon our embodied nature, is plainly obvious. Because they are linked to the animal kingdom, our bodies are by their very design of a sexually complementary or binary male-female sort, deriving specifically from the genetic karyotypes of XX for females, XY for males. Because we have animal-like bodies, we are sexed. Further, that human sexuality as an embodied reality is teleologically hardwired for a predetermined end, namely procreation, is also plainly obvious. Note here, this does not mean that we always need to be intending to have a child when we're having sex. It's rather that we must respect the procreative design of the sexual act. Unless we wish to abstract biology outright from our sex nature, it's impossible to deny or dismiss this fact. Male-female sexual dimorphism, looked at on the level strict biology, consider just the genitals, say, targets procreation in the same way, say, that respiration targets the oxygenation of the blood. Pleasure is not the primary purpose of sex. Procreation is. Now, this doesn't mean that pleasure plays no role in sex or that it's bad. No, it's part of God's design, and it's good, and we wouldn't do it if there weren't pleasure that we got out of it. It's just not the primary good. It's subordinate to higher goods. One of those being procreation. Now, stressing the ordering to procreation, I don't mean to signal that sex serves no other purpose than procreation, or to undersell this other purpose. As the human being is no mere body, so neither is human sexuality merely expressive of our embodied nature, nor simply ordered to a bodily good, that being procreation. After all, if we say human sexuality is ordered exclusively to procreation, we in no way distinguish human sex from purely animal sex. That we know there is a radically profound difference is betrayed by the very distinctive phrase we use to signify sexual union among humans, making love, a phrase we would never use to signify sex among animals. Indeed, the very physical manner of sexual union among humans, namely frontal and face-to-face, unique in the animal kingdom, in its own way testifies mightily to this difference. Simply put, human sexual union is expressive not simply of a physical union, but of an encounter of persons, of what John Paul II's theology of the body calls a communion of persons. How else should we look upon the bodily frontal posture face-to-face than as expressive of a union that serves spiritual, moral, and emotional needs in addition to physical needs? Human sexuality thus enjoys a per se ordering not merely to procreation, but also to a complementary lovemaking union. Because this latter ordering is proper to us as rational beings, as persons, moralists term this the personalist or the unitive ordering of sex. We see then how human sexuality is expressive of our body-soul structure in a uniquely privileged way. The procreative ordering of our sexuality follows immediately upon our embodied animal-like nature, and the unitive ordering follows immediately upon our rational nature. And because body and soul are one, so must these two orderings always be together. So the next step is a foregone one. Because sex is owing to our body-soul composite nature, owns a twofold per se ordering to procreation and to unitive love, we can say that it has an intrinsic teleological ordering to marriage. That is, to a union that is designed of its very nature to produce progeny and to unify two persons of complementary sexual design in love. Only marriage unites the procreative and unitive dimensions as corresponding to the indivisible, substantial union of body and soul. Human sexuality thus has a nuptial grammar written into it. Marriage marks the normative good of our sexuality. Sex is about marriage, which means, yes, it's for the benefit of the spouses, but it's also for the benefit of our children. The biblical witness reveals the same. In the first creation account of Genesis, we learn that God fashions us male and female for the express purpose of, quote, being fruitful and multiplying, Genesis 1, 27-28. That is, for the express purpose of procreation. The second creation account places the focus squarely upon what we've called the unitive or the personalist dimension of human sexuality, in that God fashions the first woman to serve as a true companion or a friend to the first man, Genesis 2, 18-24. Taken together, then, the two biblical creation accounts make clear that God has endowed his human creatures with a sex nature for the twofold yet inseparable purpose of procreation and unitive love. The Genesis creation account affirms that human sexuality is a gift from God, ordered to marriage. God has instituted it. which alone, marriage alone, joins the procreative union. If I can put it in kind of negative terms, the body is meant for no other form of sexual intimacy than that between husband and wife in an embrace of procreative unitive love. Incidentally, if the ordering of our sexuality to marriage is, as Pope Benedict says, inscribed in human nature itself, it should resonate with all people, right? So then why is the meaning and purpose of sex so disputed? Well, in response, I hold up for your consideration
The Sound of Music. Seen the movie? Okay. So, how many of you like the movie? Most everyone likes it, right?
Now, so, you watch The Sound of Music. How many of you find yourselves rooting for the Baroness? Anybody? What gives? She's beautiful, she's graceful, she's wealthy. It's not like she and the captain don't have any affections for each other. How many of you find yourselves rooting for Maria? Why? She's quirky, she's this funny nun type. Why? Why are we all in Maria's corner? She and the captain truly love each other, don't they? You know, there's that great scene in the garden, you remember it well, when they confess their love for each other. Okay? We all love the kiss of true love in movies. Disney has made the kiss of true love famous. But notice what the kiss of true love, notice how it's always portrayed. It's a chaste kiss, isn't it? It's a kiss of pure love. That is a kiss of purity. Okay, thought experiment. Let's say the captain and the baroness, that they love each other in the same way that Maria and the captain love each other. How many of you still give the vote to Maria? Why? Because she loves the children. She loves the children. If children were incidental to marriage, that wouldn't make a difference, would it? Do you see? Deep down we know children are not incidental to sex. They're not incidental to marriage. Deep down we know that they are essential too. Marriage is also for the sake of our children. Okay, there's that, of course, that great scene in The Sound of Music where the Baroness is trying to play ball with his children. You know, it's not going well. Etc. Okay, and so it's because of this, it's a vision of beauty and happiness. I think that's why it resonates within us and why we enjoy it. We find ourselves drawn to it. You know the wedding scene in The Sound of Music? Ladies, how many of you don't want a wedding like that? What does that say? Why does that draw us so much? Why do we find that so attractive? You should think about that. Well, I thought about it. Okay. As a segue to the Q&A then, I'll end by noting that immoral sexual practices, any and all of them, seek on the hylomorphic account of the human person to separate in some form or fashion the procreative ordering from the unitive one. Whether we're talking about procreative free acts, examples are obvious, contraception, homoerotic acts, etc., or unitive free acts, examples are also obvious, rape, hookup sex, etc. The result is the same. Dehumanizing acts that deny our procreative unitive sex design and thus deny our integrated nature. Such acts attempt to further one ordering at the expense of the other, usually the unitive or personalist at the exclusion of the procreative. These acts deny, at least in practice, the fundamental unity of the human being as a body-soul procreative unitive composite. And those who hold that it is permissible to separate the unitive and the procreative purposes of sex do so implicitly or explicitly on an appropriated Cartesianist or materialist anthropology. Listen, people are certainly free to take a Cartesianist approach to sexual lifestyles and relationships if they wish. But if they do, they should at least be honest that that's what they're doing, and thus that they're harboring a disdain of the body when they do. So with that, I will close. I thank you for your attention, and let's open it up to Q&A.